Your name is?
Larry Sullivan.
And where were you born, Larry?
Truro, Nova Scotia.
Truro. And did you join the Air Force from Truro?
Truro, Nova Scotia.
You did. What were your parents' names, Larry?
James Sullivan, Margaret Sullivan.
So you enlisted, you were in Halifax?
Halifax.
And where were you posted to?
Lachine, Quebec.
And from Lachine?
I went to St. Hubert, Quebec.
What did you do at St. Hubert?
Build lawns, paint aircraft.
Well, that was Joe Jobs.
Right. And then we went from there to Mongely, Quebec for air gunner training.
Right. What dates were those approximately there?
June 42 until finished air gunner training in April 43.
So, how many were on the course? Do you remember the course number?
It would usually be 45.
45 on the course?
Yeah.
And do you remember the course number at Montjoly?
I think it was 48.
48. And from there, you'd have a leave, I suppose, and went home?
Yeah, then we went to Halifax and went on a train from Halifax to New York and Brooklyn Yards, left from the Queen Elizabeth for Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a train from Scotland to Bournemouth, England.
Right. And where were you posted then from Bournemouth?
Bournemouth, England. We went to Cottesmore OTU, which was an operational training unit,
right,
in Cottesmore, England.
Right.
And then from there we went to another training unit, then we went to Market Harbor, which was a third training unit. And then I went on a fighter affiliation course, And from there I went to Lancaster training. Okay.
Right.
And that was at Widgley.
Right.
Terrible place.
Yeah.
Freezing cold. Terrible damn place.
Damn.
Damn.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, people used to say, if you're shot down, it couldn't be worse than here.
Yeah.
The food was just the same,
right,
as you're going to be in the,
prison camp. Yeah.
Right.
How old were you then? I forgot to ask you.
20 years old.
20 years old. What was your birth date?
June 22nd, 26, 22.
22.
22. So, okay. I'd be 21 years old.
Right. So from there you went where?
From there we went to Squadron 207 Squadron.
Well, had you crewed up at that time?
We crewed up at OTU.
Oh.
And then you go to, and you went to through to Lancaster training, and then you picked up another air gunner and a flight engineer, and then you went on a squadron.
And any idea why you got teamed up with a particular group you did?
Well, they come and asked me to fly with them. Mm-hmm. Three of the crew had flown 20 trips on Bostons, and Doug Smith from New Zealand, and Ronald Petz, and Mac McCarthy was their name, so they had done 20 trips on Bostons.
Right.
And the reason they were sent to Bomber Command, because they did a little too much low flying,
right,
and so they came in Bomber Command. So they asked me to crew up with them, so that's how I...
And would you tell me something about the members of your crew, their names and their positions and so on?
Well, Doug Smith was from Auckland, New Zealand, and he was a pilot.
He was a pilot. Yeah.
And McCarthy was from Liverpool. He was a navigator.
Right.
And the flight engineer was from Leeds, England, right, and he's still living. And the bombardier was from near London, England, and he's passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And rear gunner was from he lives on the Duke of Bedford's estate. It's the only house that's on the original Duke of Bedford's estate.
Oh, that's
in Bedford.
Yeah, in Bedfordshire, yeah.
Yeah, Duke of Bedford's estate.
I've driven by it a number of times.
Yeah, well, he lives in a small little town there, it's about right on the Duke of Bedford's estate.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, who am I missing? Wireless operator was Ronald Petz, and he came from London. He's since passed away.
So how many of the crew are still alive?
Four.
Four. Well, that's.
But this was the first crew.
Yeah.
So I did 20 trips with this crew, and then flown with other crews besides. Total of eight crews I flew with, eight different crews.
Goodness. And the squadron number?
207 squadron.
207.
I was in five groups.
Now, tell me, people think OTU hasn't much danger to it, but when I read the casualty list, I find that a lot of people had accidents at OTU. How did you
Well, later on, and when pilots used to be finish their tour and go to OTU, some of them, because of the inexperienced pilots coming through with not too much training, it was safer to fly in operations than it was in OTU. Because of the older aircraft and the new pilots were coming along, they were just didn't have the experience.
Right, right. So, do you remember your first trip?
Certainly do. I went on a spare to Berlin December 16th, 43. I went with a pilot officer Giddens. His name was Jack Giddens. Right. And all of our crew went that night as spares. So, and then...
Including the pilot who'd be the second dicky, was that right?
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct.
Right.
And then when we got over the coast, why the navigator says we're just crossing the coast. Well, at that particular time, a fighter attacked us, and this thing went, the aircraft went charging down like this, where you're supposed to corkscrew, and we went charging down, and the two gun handles broke off in my hand.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
this was on the Lank, was it?
This was on a Lancaster. So, it was only held on by two little screws, which were, and when you get, when you, the aircraft goes down, you want to depress the gun, so this was the power of the thing, so when you're scared, that's how much power you got. So, we just kept on to the target, went to Berlin, came back, and this was the night of the big fog. Very, hundreds of aircraft were either crashed in England because they couldn't land out of the fog. And the one squadron lost, I think, 11 or 12 aircraft, 97 squadron that night. And they couldn't land, they were just crashing everywhere. And they got the call to land, and flight engineer of our aircraft says, what's that man doing there? And we were flying tip to another Lank, was flying right, coming into land. And the other Lank put on a burst and he went around. And after we had landed, I looked at the surroundings and we were at the wrong airdrome. We were at 57th Squadron, East Kirby.
So you got off to a great start.
That was a good start. All that crew is gone. Kept track of all that crew is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the next trip was the second trip. We went to Berlin, and I went with my own pilot this time.
Yeah.
And on this particular occasion, I was attacked by a night fighter. He didn't actually attack me. He came at an angle on the port side, and he wasn't attacking me. He had just set a Lancaster on fire, and the Lancaster left engine was on fire, and then after that he came towards us, and he didn't actually see us, and I fired at him, and he went down in flames, and we didn't know until, just a few years ago, when Martin Middlebrook, he wrote a book about all the Berlin raids. And I, after reading the book, he interviewed the German crew who shot down this Lancaster, and it just happened that this Lancaster was from our squadron. Mm-hmm. And the pilot, his name is Moulton Barrett, and he lives in Florida now.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him this winter, and he told me what had happened and everything. Martin Middlebrook interviewed the German crew and asked them what happened. He said, we were hit from underneath, and we immediately dived to 10,000 feet and then bailed out. So So this was the only Lancaster, the only Junkers 88 shot down that night. It's in my logbook, and it was confirmed by two other squadrons at the time. Mm-hmm. So what I didn't know until this book was written, who the man was. So I gave a talk in Florida at the meeting there last winter, and he was the president of the, what they call it, RAF, Warbirds Association.
Oh, yes.
Of America. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a few pilots, USA pilots, ex-Canadian pilots who transferred to the RAF, to U.S. Air Force, etc.
Mm-hmm. So, and that was, you said, Junkers 88?
Junkers 88.
Yeah. Were they the most common night fighter?
I would say, yes, they didn't have the ME-109, they had the ME-110 and the Junkers 88. The ME-109s, they didn't have that much radar on them to come up at night.
Right, right.
So there wasn't that many, the Junkers 88s and the ME-110. Later on, it was the ME-410, it was an ME-410,
right.
And so forth.
Yeah. So your first two were pretty exciting trips.
Well, yeah. I flew another spare right at the next trip. I flew a spare with a pilot officer, Drain. Okay, mm-hmm. He ended up doing 60 some trips before he was killed in a mosquito. But his rear gunner is still, he's the secretary of our association in England, air gunner, you know, the association.
Yeah. So go on and tell me some more about the other trips.
The first, later on we went to Brunswick one night, and the target was supposed to be marked, and there were about 20 minutes later marking the target, and everything was the target, and all the aircraft were going around in a circle in the meantime. But when it come time that the markers did go down, you know that all these here aircraft are going to come charging in there like a bunch of fish, and there was many times that night of people have come back, us in particular, where we nearly hit another Lancaster head on.
Right.
So another night we were going to near Schweinfurt, and we used to have what they call a window to put in the aircraft. Well, we used to use this window and put it in the bomb bay, and figured if it was good enough for the radar, it was good enough for, we were going to carry it. So when we were caught in searchlights, we'd open the bomb bays and shove out the window. And we got caught over a small town called Ullum.
Mm-hmm.
And we got hit by a direct searchlight, and we made just a 90 degree turn and threw out the window and kept on going. Searchlights followed the window.
Oh.
And we had got caught in another night over the Ruhr. If you probably remember, I think this is when the first occasion when they knew about the jet stream was they were going to Berlin this night, and when they came back, all the aircraft were blown off course. We ended up over the Ruhr Valley and down in the southern part of England, and a couple of aircraft missed the southern part of England because of the jet stream.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when the first knew, really about what happened to the jet stream, how they could put you off course.
Mm-hmm.
Could
I go back to that business of the window and the searchlight? If it worked for you, I had never heard of it being employed by anyone else. Why wouldn't have that been a...
Well, we employed a few things which you had to employ in order to survive. One thing was, in the Lancaster aircraft, you put your turret outside the rear turret, okay, your parachute outside the turret, so you had to open the door. In order to open the door on the rear turret, you had to reach around with your left hand over your right shoulder and push the door open. So we immediately put a cable on the door here and a pulley over here so we could immediately pull the door open. We also had, in order to get to the door, if an aircraft was at night, we had a rope from where our parachute was to the door. So when you got out there, if it was dark and everything like that, you followed the rope to the door. But when you got to the door, They never did change that. They had a little lock on the door, a Yale lock, which was about 1 inch in diameter, and you had these giant gloves, and you couldn't to open those instead of putting a handle on the door. This was things that you had to do in order to survive.
I'm sometimes struck by the lack of safety features that were used. It just seemed as though they didn't really count on saving a lot of lives other than with parachutes. Sometimes the hatches weren't big enough. Some of the things you're describing seem so simple and obvious, you wonder why they weren't adopted.
Well, they had to go through channels. If you wanted something done, they had to go through channels. I flew with a wing commander after that, and I talked to him about having a parachute in a rear turret. Well, it was just about, the conflict was about over by the time they got this thing, parachute in a rear turret. Of course, we were never going to go out to the rear turret. We were going to go out, turn the turret, and go out to the turret. Mm. We practiced that at the drome on about three mattresses of doing that. They turn the turret around and go out through the turret. Because if the aircraft was on fire, the flames are going to come towards you, and you get to the door, and you can't open the door, and et cetera. And after you open the door, you're liable to get hit by the tail plane.
Well, are you telling me that they didn't expect you to go out through the turret? Is that what you're saying? They expect you to go back?
You had to kind of do that. As this year, you did everything on your own. There was nobody that told you which was the best way to get out, or the, et cetera, you know.
Because I always assumed that from the rear turret, they just turned it around and dropped out.
Most of them went out the doors. Very few did that.
Oh, is that right?
That's right.
They went back into the aircraft and found the hatch.
Well, it wasn't a hatch. It was a door on the right-hand side.
Oh, a door on the right-hand side.
Okay, a door on the right-hand side. The door would come open like that, and out to go. That was fine if you were, I suppose.
Well, it was as long as you could open the door, it wasn't jammed with the gunfire, and there wasn't any fire between you and the door.
Yeah, it depends on whether the aircraft was going down.
Yeah.
If you were badly hit in the aircraft, usually if two engines were out, the aircraft usually went down.
Yeah.
So if you had to get downhill, and the force of going downhill, you had nothing to hold on to get to the door. And you didn't have too many seconds until the thing would blow up.
So this is probably what explains why, what is it, 1 in 8 were all that ever made it safely out when the plane were...
I suppose.
In the RAF. I think it was 1 in 3 in the U.S., if I remember correctly.
Yeah,
of course, it was daylight just then. So carry on about some of these trips. I know.
Well, we went to, just lately, they had, after I did 23 trips, I hooked up with a wing commander, Gray. He happened to be a squadron leader at the time. Then our wing commander went missing. And the wing commander that went missing had been, his name was Vic Wheeler. He was a World War I pilot, and he had done a tour on night fighters. And he was the man who recommended Bob Braham, the great night fighter pilot, who later came to Canada for his first DSO. Mm-hmm. Now, he flew in World War I, and then he did a tour of night fighters, and then he went from a group captain to a wing commander to command 207 Squadron. Mm-hmm. He had about 5 trips, and then in Frankfurt he was shot down, and he had flown for Junkers between the wars. And he was given a military funeral by the Germans. Mm-hmm. The next wing commander was Wing Commander Gray, who I started to fly with. Mm-hmm. Now, the other gunner on this crew was, he was Flying Officer McIntosh. He was my instructor at Fighter Affiliation School. Mm-hmm. He had done a tour earlier in 43. Mm-hmm. And we were friends then, so then I started to fly with the Wing Commander Gray. After about 3 trips, we went to, it was the day after D-Day, on the 7th. We went to, it's called Forest de Cerisy, and just over the border near, the town was named Balleroy, okay, near St. Lowe, And the town was called Valeroy, but there was, tanks were in this here forest, and this is what we were bombing. The thing was then, the Allies said, well, we have control of the air, you know, possibly in the daytime, but not at night. We shot down the Junkers 88 after, as we got over the North Sea, coming back. Immediately, another Junkers 88, and we shot this down, and he blew up underneath us.
Well, now, how in the world were you able to spot the German plane before he spotted you? Or I'd like a little more explanation.
On this particular night, if you want to go back to when I joined the Air Force, when I joined at Halifax, this is the third station I tried to join, because I have one bad eye.
Right.
Okay, I'm looking at you now, and you can see that I have one eye. It's called non-binocular vision. And it later, I found out that I could see better at night with this other eye, because when you look at an object at night, you have to look to the side of the object.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I could see, they can call them cat's eyes, whatever you have.
Yeah.
But I just concentrated on seeing the aircraft before he saw us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this particular night, we were more or less in the darkness, and the fighters that we saw were coming up, and they were in the light. We saw them before they saw us.
Mm-hmm.
And the second fighter blew up underneath us and raised us up in the air about five times as much as when you would drive a drop a cookie, okay? We went for about another 20 minutes, and another ME-410 came. And, of course, we thought that he was going to go for some Lancasters near us, because they had their lights on. We're nearly to the coast of England.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, he comes up behind us, and we blast away at him, and he goes down on fire, and he landed on the coast of England. Now, the next day, that aircraft was recovered on the coast of England.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only time that three night fighters were shot down by air gunners at night. World War II.
So I suppose you and the other gunner were both firing, so
right.
So you, the two of you were given credit for the three aircraft on that one trip.
Right.
What was the other air gunner's name?
His name was Flight Officer McIntosh.
He's
a good friend of mine. He comes to see me every year in Florida.
Well.
And he came this year to Florida, stayed about 8 weeks.
And was there any other occasion when three fighters were shot down by
no,
a bomb?
No, there's only two night fighter pilots that shot down three fighters in one night.
Is
John Cunningham and one Canadian.
Is that right?
In one night.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
We were, later on, we went to Stuttgart after that, and we shot down, we were attacked at five times going over Stuttgart, and we shot down two night fighters that night.
Two in the one night again?
Two, yeah.
Would you like to describe that?
This here, we were weaving, and it was fires, and we were weaving, and both seen the night fighter at the same time, and he didn't get a chance to fire at us, and he was just trying to maneuver, you know, to get in on us, and he went down in flames. And then as we were leaving the target, we shot down another night fighter as we were leaving, and he went down the plane.
Well, now, in those cases, do you think you saw them before?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, because
absolutely.
If they saw you first, you really wouldn't have...
Only one time when a night fighter saw me first. On a previous occasion, when I was flying with the Smith crew, my oxygen froze up, and... it's called anoxia, I guess, when you're when you don't have any oxygen.
Right.
And I passed out, and the pilot sent the wireless operator back and with an extra bottle, and he came back and revived me, and I finally came to, and I had a tremendous headache because of lack of oxygen, and the pilot decided to go down to 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this was coming back from a trip, I think it was either Leipzig or Berlin. And he went down to 10,000 feet. Well, I have a hard time keeping my eyes open, and throwing up all over the place. And I swung the turret around, and I'm searching like this, and all of a sudden I come around, and here's a night fighter, an ME-109 right there. I can see the pilot has just, had just come up on radar. And I just hollered dive, because my microphone is on all the time. So I just hollered dive. And we just disappeared and we lost him. But that's on one occasion. Another occasion when encountered a night fighter. If you look at the turret which is out here, there was a turret was that I flew in, a place on the left-hand side where you took the turret around and you actually couldn't see below. You could see below.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? At this particular night, I could see I don't know if it was a fighter or whatever was below. You can't tell when it's pitch black, you know. So I said to the pilot, I said, it's just corkscrew. And he just tore over all over the place. So we level back up again, and I look, and here's this fighter again. I think it's a fighter. So I says, corkscrew. So we just tore over, because I can't fire at him. He just tore all over the place. So in the meantime, the navigator, his pencils are over, his maps are everywhere, and everything is flying all over the place. So he said, you've got to be blind, he said, over the microphone. So it more than about 4 or 5 seconds, flight engineer looks out and he says, there he is. And he was an ME-110 sitting out here on her wingtip. Neither of us were both in shock and seeing it so close. And I suppose he stayed there and the navigator came up and took a look at him right like that, because he just came out of his compartment when he said that. And then the night fighter tipped his wings like this and took off. I didn't trust him, so I says, dive again. Well, we just dive again. And when I but here was a case of that night fighter trying to creep up underneath, and I did see him, but I couldn't tell what kind of a plane he was. It was just a black object. But now whether he absolutely, he's going to come in on us. I don't know why, what happened, why, but he just tipped his wings like that, and the pilot, our pilot and crew could see him just as plain in there. He had the lights on in the cabin, and he just tipped his wing once, like twice like this, and then took off.
Maybe he just didn't want to shoot you down.
I don't know. But we couldn't have shot him down because he was at the end of the wingtip like that.
Right.
Another occasion, and on I'm just offhand can't think of the name, and I just looked out my logbook. We went to another small town. We did shoot down an ME-109 this night, and after we left the target.
So what you're saying is that you attribute your success. And I must emphasize that it was rare for an air gunner ever to shoot down.
Yeah. It was very rare because of we had 303 ammunition, which is World War I ammunition, and all it was the Enfield rifle speeded up. And you could shoot 1,100 rounds a minute out of there, which came up with both gunners firing. We came to 44 rounds, of, I think 77 rounds a second or something. Yeah. And the story was, or the training that we were undertaking, the people who would do the fighter affiliation was a Spitfire pilot, usually. And he would come in on you, and you had a camera gun, and he had a camera gun. And of course, when he would tip his wing to come in on you, he would have to come in from the port side. He would tip his right wing first to come in on you, and then go like this. Now, that was fine, you know, it was in the daytime and so forth. And you were supposed to go into this corkscrew, and you had the first, when you dive port, so forth, and dive 200 50 feet, and then you were going to go up 250 feet. Right now, I just can't exactly say if it was 250 or 200. Mm. And then you went down and up and so forth. It sounded great on paper. Mm. It sounded good on paper to do this. It sounded, with the camera gun, you know what I mean? They came back and who shot down who, it was hard to tell, but that was all in fun. But when it came to the fighter at night, usually he came in to 400 yards before he would, okay, to 400 yards before he would make an attack. He didn't attack from 1,000 yards like they did in daytime, which would be 400 yards. Sometimes they came in closer, 400. You had to see him first, the fighter. That was the secret of seeing the fighter first. If you didn't, it was all over.
Yeah, so, but after seeing him first, you also had to be a good shot.
Well, the thing was that they trained us to say, after you saw the fighter, it says you immediately, first it took you time. You had to turn your microphone on.
Yes.
You had to look through your ring sight.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
From the time the fighter saw you, if he saw you, once he was set up, if he saw you, it was 2 seconds. You just had the 2 seconds. From the time he saw you, you just had the 2 seconds until you're out of there, okay?
Right.
So when they trained you to say this, say to the pilot, fighter, starboard, whatever it is, and then they say dive, port, go, your 2 seconds are used up.
Right.
So I'd imagine many people went through that stage, their 2 seconds were used up. So it was just dive and get out of the way.
Yeah.
Just dive and get out. You had to shoot first and then get out of the way.
Right.
We were never hit by any bullets.
Is that
we were
right?
Hit by flak. We were shot down by flak.
Is that
twice.
Right? In other words, in all your trips,
never
your
hit,
plane
never
was
hit,
never
no.
hit by a bullet.
No.
That is remarkable.
I flew with one, two, I think, about six or seven different aircraft. But no, we never hit by a bullet. But we were hit by flak.
Right, which is a totally different thing.
Yeah.
So, and you, how many trips then did you say you did?
35.
That was one tour.
Yeah, well, at the particular time in 1944, they were going on and on and on.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And
sure.
They wanted to give at one particular time one third of a trip.
Yes.
For going over France and everything
right.
like that.
Yes.
But after D-Day, when they went to one occasion, our squadron lost 6 aircraft in one night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was June 22nd, 44. And we lost 6 from our squadron in one night. There's 42 people missing from the mess hall. And then after that, they decided we better not call it one third of a trip.
Mm-hmm.
See? And usually people were going over 35 and 34 and so forth. And a lot of crews were missing on 27 trips and 25 trips and so on.
You keep in touch with the survivors of your crew or crews?
Oh yeah, we had a reunion a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and but like I say, they're getting older now.
right.
Yeah.
You've been back a few times?
Oh yeah, I was in 85 the last, no, 85, 91 was the last time, and a pilot came from New Zealand, and mm-hmm. there were 6 of us in.
Right.
And we still hold the 207 Squadron reunion
right.
in England every year,
right.
And there was 936 killed from our 207 Squadron. And I have the book of all the total, you know, the casualties, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was 936 killed just from 207 Squadron, which was the second highest in Bomber Command.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you have the DFC in Bar?
Right, correct.
And do you mind if I ask you what they say when the award is given? What this is?
Well, I got the DFC for the night we shot down 3 aircraft in one night.
Right.
And then later, a total of 7 aircraft, I got the Bar later on.
Right.
But I didn't, I came back and got out of the service, and then I went back in the service as, in 1946, in June 46, I went back in the service, and I entered at Trenton,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to, I resigned my commission to order to go take this photography course,
mm-hmm.
and when I found out there was no course available, at the time, they hadn't got the building ready.
Mm-hmm.
So it was going to be 6 months before the course. Well, I couldn't see myself walking around for 6 months, so I put in for a discharge. But in the meantime, I got the job of painting and renovating this whole building, which they were going to use for the photography course.
Mm-hmm.
And I got out in December after we were there 6 months, and I got out. Mm-hmm. But in 1948, I had got a letter that there was going to be an investiture
mm-hmm.
right here at the University of Toronto here to give me my DSC in bar.
Oh.
And when the man, there was a few Americans here at the time, and when it was Lieutenant Governor Lawson,
mm-hmm.
and when the man read off the citation, he said LAC. And the American guy afterwards said, what happened to you? So LAC with the DSC in bar. So I'm only LAC.
So did you enjoy your life in the Air Force?
I wouldn't have missed it for a day.
No. Would you like to comment on the valor and the horror?
I will say one thing. I suppose a few things that were, I haven't read the book.
No, nor have
all I.
Did you see the movie?
I didn't see the movie.
Oh, you
haven't
seen
read
that.
The book.
Okay.
One thing I will say, without having read the book or seeing the movie,
yeah.
One crew came to our squadron one time, and of course it was just press on, and et cetera, and full, what was the name for full, everybody.
Full steam ahead.
No, there was another name. And anyway, this crew came, and I had just received the commission at the time, and my name was on to pack their clothes. And they put their things by the mess hall. They just arrived on the squadron. And they were immediately sent out on ops. And the next day, I was the one who was in charge of looking after their clothing and everything like that, and so forth. They never even had a chance to unpack their clothes. They were still by the mess hall. And I think that they should have been given a chance. You know, every aircraft had to be, if they had an aircraft, there had to be a crew in it to go, you know what I mean? And I think that there was a little too much of this here, of getting every aircraft in the air, even though it wasn't airworthy.
Yes.
We went to, I hear stories in books about when the boys used to come back and they got their bacon and eggs and everything. Well, we didn't get any bacon and eggs when we came back. You only got your two eggs when you went in operation.
Right.
So I can figure out how many eggs I ate in England. I ate 70 because I did 35 trips. Because that's the only time you got your bacon and eggs,
right.
When you come back.
Right.
We went to a squadron one night in a beat up truck. We were to go over there to take over an aircraft. It was 44 Squadron, Waddington. When we got there, it was pouring down rain. We got out to the aircraft. We got in this aircraft, and I says, "You never take off in this aircraft. This was a wreck. This was a wreck." Anyway, I said to Doug Smith, our pilot, I says, "We're not going to take off in this aircraft." And we got to the end of the mess hall, and we're going to have our meal and everything, and I am 2 people away from getting my eggs, and it was called off, and I didn't get the eggs. I got in the truck and threw it all the way back to our station.
What about LMF? Any comment on that?
LMF?
Yeah.
I suppose the Americans on their stations. When people would get, they call them flak happy, the eyebrows would twitch, especially the pilots. Their eyebrows would twitch, and it was a nervous, it was, you know, especially people who flew in 43 and 44. People who flew in 42, they didn't have the good aircraft that they had later on, but it doesn't matter if it was a good aircraft or a bad aircraft, the fighter still shot you down.
Yeah.
They didn't have that many fighters, see. Germans produced in 1944, even though all the bombing in 1944 produced 44,000 fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So one night, like for instance Nuremberg, when they shot down 69 bombers in 3/4 hour, the Germans had 250 fighters in the air that night.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to what you were going to say, they put too many aircraft in the air that weren't, they weren't,
shouldn't have been flying.
They shouldn't have been flying.
They were airworthy, yeah.
Especially on OTUs. I crashed at Wimpy at OTU. We just took off as an Australian pilot and an Australian trainee pilot. We just took off and a bunch of air gunners on an exercise. And all of a sudden the smoke comes from the engine and he says, well, put her down there. So the aircraft, I saw the Australian pilot, the instructor since then. He lives in Australia. I've written to him. And he had an air gunner who came, lived in Toronto, right around here. And it was his air gunner. This was on 97 Squadron. And when they did the first tour, when they were, he was on the OTU, he was an instructor. Anyway, he said, put it down. We missed the, took the top off a spruce tree with the wing, and then we missed the church steeple by about 10 feet, and we went into a cornfield. See, crashed into a cornfield, and I was in the rear turret, and immediately after hitting the ground, I bailed out of the rear turret, went flying through the cornfield, and it did catch on fire, but they got the fire extinguisher and put the fire out. But this is what you had to go to before, or even got on operations, you know, many, many. If you read the book that's putting out about all the Canadians who got killed, you'll find out that there was a couple of OTUs or a couple of Lancaster training and Sterling training were terrible casualties.
Yes, yes.
Terrible casualties.
No question, no question.
Terrible casualties.
So, getting back to LMF, did you know anyone that nerves cracked up and couldn't fly before his tour was completed?
I would say someone very close to us was our own navigator.
Yes.
On our last trip, we went to, I think it was Brunswick on our last trip when he got lost, and the wireless operator came up and said, Max, the maps is all over the place and he's given up. So the pilot immediately put it in George and went down and said, he says, you better get us back or get your parachute on and get out. So all of a sudden he's asking me questions, where are we, or are we over the Zuider Zee? And I don't know what the Zuider Zee even is, you know. Hmm. And I can't see anything down there. It's pitch black. I'm not supposed to be looking down there anyway. I'm supposed to be, you know. So anyway, we did get back that night, and that was the last trip we'd done. And later on in years, I said to Doug Smith, our pilot in New Zealand, I said, I've never been able to find old Mac. And he said, maybe he doesn't want to be found.
No.
And I didn't know about this until later. But I guess there was certain things. But
well,
the Americans, they had a place to put these,
yes,
to rest them. They had a homes in England, right, where they went and rested for a period and then come back.
The RAF method was really cruel.
The RAF method was just get in there and blunder, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You think that LMF and all that sort of thing, you know what I mean? And if you would find out later, the final total was, when I go looking for pilots, there's not too many left.
Yeah.
Because the pilot had terrific responsibility looking after, he don't even have to get to the target and back, he had to look after all these crew.
Yeah.
He had to look after all these crew in the ground, too.
Yeah.
And he had to make sure that they were all, you know, ready to fly and operational on the ground and be able to buy the drinks in the pubs and stuff like this, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So he had a big responsibility. So I know all the pilots that are from our squadron, 207 Squadron, there's only two or three left.
No,
of all those pilots that we knew and all those pilots who, there's only two or three left. A lot of air gunners left and a lot of other crew, but the pilots, I think, I found it later, a good friend of mine, and was a great fighter pilot, George Hill. George Hill shot down 16 aircraft. He came and picked in Nova Scotia. Of course, he was a doctor in Orangeville, and I heard that he had an alcohol problem, and quite a few pilots did have alcohol problems, related because of this tremendous stress that they could never recover from.
You're right. I come from the next town north of Orangeville. I remember reading about
George Hill and I were in Halifax Hospital together, and we were in the same room in the Halifax Hospital together.
He had the DFC in two bars, is that
That's correct. That's correct. And he had a degree before he went into the service, George. He had a degree before he went in, and later he came out, and he when we were in the hospital, I asked him what he was going to do. He says, I'm going to be a doctor. And after that, I didn't see him after that until just a few years ago. I looked him up, and I have a nephew in Truro, Nova Scotia, and he started asking around where George Hill was. So he asked around, and this guy gave him the picture and his whole history. He was a friend of his.
So you come off, well, you flew to Berlin and Stuttgart and where else?
I did 9 trips to Berlin.
9.
I did 2 to Stuttgart and Frankfurt, Schweinfurt, Augsburg, Essen, 2 to Leipzig, and Königsberg, mostly major targets. But even though there were German targets, and after the D-Day, they wanted to give people 1/3 of a trip. Well, the French targets were really tough too. Because when one target, there was 42 aircraft shot down in 20 minutes, 42 Lancasters. It was 1 group and 5 group went on that. And the casualties were still, still piling up.
Very, very, very high.
The Lancasters didn't have any self-sealing tanks like the Fortress.
No.
And so they didn't, once they're hit by bullets, the tanks were hit by bullets, they just caught on fire.
And did the pilot have any armor plating?
I think they did just his back position, if I remember. Yeah.
Right. So now you finish your tour. What date is that?
Well, they wanted to send me, I was in pretty bad shape as far as, I think the worst thing, the problem that I had was the food. I think I had ulcers at the time and didn't know it.
Right.
So when I came back in the hospital in Halifax, I fixed my nose, which had been broken a couple of times. And they fixed that, and like I say, I knew I had ulcers at then, and there was people in there that had them, but I didn't know about them until later years.
No.
Years later, I had them bleeding ulcers and had them operated on.
So you came off your, after your tour, you were sent home right away.
Right, absolutely.
You didn't do any instructing or anything like that?
No.
And what date was that?
That was December of 44.
Oh, so then...
And then I just waited around for about 3 months before I was disbanded,
Yeah, so you'd be out fairly early then.
Out in January 45.
Oh, you were discharged in January 45.
Yeah, I think it was January 45.
Yeah, that's possible because they were certainly discharging people by that time in anticipation of the wars getting over. So I was out in March 45. We never got past graduation. And that was after 30 days leave. So I would think that would be about right.
Yeah.
And you keep in touch, you said, with most of your former crew?
We write all the time.
Right.
Yeah, we write all the time.
But that, if I may say so, is unusual. Most people lose touch with their crewmates.
I think we had a good relationship on our crew. We went everywhere together. We didn't make friends with anybody else on the squadron. And we stuck together, except when you went on leave. You went on 7 different ways when you went on leave.
Yeah.
When you come back, you were back, and if you went here together, or so-and-so, you stuck together, you played cards together, you usually went out together and so forth, and then you didn't go with any other crews to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So all the experiences you went through were later on, you're pretty close.
Yeah. But even so, most of the ones, close as they were, drifted apart, and it seems as though you didn't.
I happened to look up a few years ago. I came to Canada and I searched down. I spent 6 years in the personnel business.
Oh, yeah.
I was a headhunter for 2 years and then I worked in contrary business for 4
right.
years.
Right.
So when it came to hunting people down and finding them, so I went all through Ontario here and hunted down the people who are on my course at Mongeley. And one lived in Mount Forest. He survived. And one lives in St. Catherine, he was shot down prisoner of war, Stalag 3. A few more were shot down, and prisoners of war. So I looked him up. One lives up by Welland, and he's still okay. He was shot down over Arnhem on D-Day, when they over Arnhem. And so I filed, I hunted them down and looked them up.
Mm-hmm.
But
One more question about your bombing trips. Did you ever feel that you were just bombing German civilians as opposed to military targets?
The only thing I think the people in my bombing or whoever it was just bombing a target. You were just bombing a target.
Whatever was designated.
Whatever was designated, you were bombing a target.
You probably couldn't tell.
They talked during the, even the Americans and the RAF about bombing and precision bombing and all this. Well, okay, if one single aircraft went over the bombing range and you got within so many feet of the target, this was usually at night or in daylight, and you were the single aircraft. But when you went to large targets like Berlin, it covers a large area, you could see the Berlin 20 minutes before you got there, all lit up, searchlights and flak and things going in this direction, and you got all these aircraft going in there, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to think you have to bomb on a heading in order to, bombs don't go sideways.
No.
They go forward, but they don't go sideways.
Right.
But you have to bomb on a certain heading. If you have to bomb on a certain heading in order to hit that target.
Yeah.
Well, all these bombers coming into Berlin, you can look out here and you can see one half a mile away, and you can see one a quarter of a mile away, and you can see one over here in the light. You know they're all not going to be all in the same heading.
Yeah.
And after the fighters get in there and start chasing them around, mixing them all up and everything like that. Usually the guys, they're supposed to get a photograph, okay, to bring back and such, you know. But you get a photograph of a bunch of flames and smoke and stuff like this. But really, you could never hit, not everybody would ever hit the target.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to get at, the charge made by the McKenna's and the Valor and the Horror, and who I understand by some authors, is that the real intent was to terrorize as opposed to destroying military targets.
That's not true. I've never heard of, nobody in the RAF or anything like that ever tried to hit any civilians or anything like that.
Yeah.
If there were anybody hit, it would be people who were just so dropping the bombs and didn't know, and just never made the target.
Well, what happened if you didn't get to your target and you had bombs? What did you do with them?
That never happened in our case.
No.
I always got to the target.
What were your instructions?
But usually you either brought them back or, you could bring them back. Some people, you were not supposed to land, I don't think, with a cookie on board.
Right.
I knew a couple of crews who did land but I don't think that was never the case.
No.
You went to a certain target.
You just didn't decide to go to another town and drop them on the other town.
Absolutely not. No. Anybody who said that, they didn't get to the real target. It wasn't very hard to get to the real target.
No, because it was all lit up, I guess.
It was all lit up like Christmas tree, usually.
Yeah.
And there was searchlights going, and usually there was at least two bombers caught in searchlights over just about all the targets, they were caught in searchlights. So
the other thing was that they took steps to make sure that you did reach your target and not just say you'd been there, too. That's why you had cameras on board.
you had cameras on board, and I flew one night with a crew as a spare, and when they get to the target, the bomb aimer, I think he missed the bombing points, and he says, "We'll have to go around again, Skipper." And I says, "You're not going around again, Skipper. We're going home." So now what I did, I don't know what he did, but we're not going around again. Because number one, you had to make a 90-degree turn through all these bombers. Just imagine that just happening over the city of Toronto of 800 bombers up here or 800 planes. And you're going around and make a turn in the middle of all those planes and come back up. And, it's not right,
So then you get out of the Air Force, you get back in, and then just give me a brief account of your life after the Air Force.
Well, after I got out of the Air Force,
Were you single when you were out of the Air Force?
Yes. I trained to be a chef at Murray's Restaurant in Toronto.
Oh, yes.
I trained to be a chef there. Got to be a chef there. In the meantime, I was studying on my own I studied building estimation and architect's blueprints. I also took courses through LaSalle Extension University in accounting. So then, after that, I went out and got in the Bricklayers Union as a bricklayer.
Right.
I later was foreman in charge of the, on the first Toronto subway, of all the masonry in the first Toronto subway.
Right.
And in 1955, I moved to Chicago and was ran work in Chicago and laid out buildings all over the Chicago area until I was 69, which was 2 years ago.
Right.
And that's...
At that tender age, you quit work?
At 69, yeah. Well, I raised my children, and I raised my four grandchildren.
You had, when did you get married?
In 57.
57, oh, you were late, so like that. And how many children?
I had one boy and two girls.
One boy, two girls.
Boy is a general contractor in Illinois.
Yeah.
Girl is an accountant,
right,
and controller of a company. The other girl is a nurse at a hospital.
Mm-hmm. And where do you live now?
Live in Larry? Sebastian, Florida.
Whereabouts is
Sebastian is about 12 miles north of Vero Beach.
Oh, yeah.
And 18 miles south of Melbourne.
And that's your, you live there year round?
We just started living there last year.
Oh, I see.
And I have a motorhome, and we leave in the motorhome in the spring,
yeah,
and travel through Canada, wherever we're going to go, for the rest of the year until we got back to Florida.
And is that better than working?
I did three jobs with my boy when I came through Illinois.
Oh,
he nailed me through two, three masonry jobs to help him put in so forth, so, and then he's got even lined up when I go back.
So you just can't stay away?
Well, he has a nice home there on the lake, and I'm putting in two round pillars,
yeah,
made out of brick.
Yeah.
And I told him, none other like it, it's going to be, you know,
right,
where he come into his, it's a quite a long road to come in, and he lives on a big lake. And when I come back, so he's going to have all the electrical set up for the lights and everything when I get back, so,
yeah,
and probably in October.
Yeah. How would you like to sum up your life? Has it been a good one?
Well, I think that I have, a lot of people have a lot of injuries and a lot of problems right now. Like I said, I was in three car crashes and three airplane crashes. I had ribs broken five times. One car crash, I was off 9 months. Another car crash, it was totaled. We're hit from behind, people going 70 miles an hour. So I had my nose broken four times, and the rib broken five times, and ankle broken twice. I've been in traction for 6 months, traction from my neck, traction from my back. So I guess when you come down to it, there's one thing that you got to have a sense of humor,
yeah,
and don't worry about the little things.
No. Just before I turn this off, just put your head down so I get that. There we go. That's it.